The regularly scheduled program will not be seen at this time to enable the Citizens for Johnson Humphrey to bring you a videotape report by the Vice President on his recent trip to Southeast Asia and a discussion of United States policy in that area. Recorded today in Minneapolis at a meeting of the State Central Committee of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. Now here is the Honorable Hubert Humphrey, Vice President of the United States.
Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, and my fellow Democrats, DFLers, and ladies and gentlemen, friends. I knew that this was going to be a bit of a hot meeting, but I didn't expect that they'd start the fire and have the smoke before I got to speaking. But I see that Mayor Nafflin wanted to have everything under control so he has the fire trucks out in front even before we get going. I want this morning to visit with you. I want to talk sense with you about our country and about our party. As has been indicated to you already, and as you know, this meeting will be a sort of give and take session. But since this is the holiday season, I thought maybe I would start giving first before I have to take. Now, I don't intend to spend very much time today on the Republican Party. I'll have quite a bit to say about the grumbling old party in the months ahead. But today I want to talk about our party, about our country. And I want to address myself to Democrats, all kinds of Democrats. Regular, irregular, liberal, conservative, green, dissenting, and concerned. And we have all those kinds of Democrats all over America, and they seem to be rather well organized. Now, my fellow Americans, most of our citizens are concerned. They're concerned about their country, they're concerned about this world, they're concerned about their jobs, and they're concerned about their health and their community and their farms, and about the directions in which we may be headed here at home and throughout the world. And most of them are concerned about the future and what lies ahead for the children, their children. So I don't think that being concerned is the special prerogative of any single party or any single group or any single individual. I believe that the word concerned, however, is an accurate description of the leadership of this country, the political leadership, and other forms of leadership, and particularly the leadership of the Johnson-Humphrey administration. But we have been more than concerned, more than wringing our hands, or more than just bemoaning some of the tragic situations that face us. That concern has been transformed into action. We've been concerned about the education of our children, particularly the deprived, and we've acted as never before in the history of this country. We've been concerned about the health of our citizens, all of our citizens, young and old, and I submit to you that we have acted as never before. And we've been concerned about the environment that surrounds us, the poisonous and dangerous pollution of water and air, and we have acted. And we've been concerned about the steady economic growth of this nation and the stability of the dollar, and we have acted. Although I might add, opposition is making it increasingly hard to act in this area. We've been concerned about the plight of our cities, and we're taking action. We've been concerned about the difficulties facing our rural people, our rural Americans, and we are acting. And we've been concerned above all about discrimination and racial injustice, which still blemishes this country. And I say that no administration in the history of this land has acted so consistently and so dramatically as this administration. And we've been concerned about the protection of the consumer, and we have acted. And we've been concerned about the well-being not only of the prosperous, but also of the underprivileged and the left out, the mentally retarded and the disturbed, and of all too many Americans who do not yet share in the blessings of this great country. And my fellow Americans, we have taken action to do something about it. And we've been concerned with reinforcing human values in a society that's grown big and impersonal, automated and neatly prepackaged, and we have acted. I thought I'd mention those concerns to you, and there are many more. There is no person in this room who believes that we've done enough. The story of our country is not its ultimate achievements, but its glorious beginnings. Just remember the words of our great presidents. A man like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who reminded us that all we had to fear was fear itself, and asked us to stand up and put America once again on its feet. A John Kennedy who said, let's get this country moving again. Let us begin. And a Lyndon Johnson who said to us, let us continue and build a great society. The whole story of our democracy, of our party, is forward progress. Franklin Roosevelt, who said, the only limitation to the realization of our tomorrows are our doubts of today. Let us move forward with a strong and active faith. This is the story of this party. But I can tell you that we never feel that we've done enough. Our commitment and our action on behalf of the kind of America that we believe in can never be fully satisfied. But when people look back over this period, I believe they will regard it as one that has made more significant breakthroughs in the face of old obstacles than at any other time in the history of this century. Yes, this has been a time of grave concern in America, but it has been equally, I say, and by necessity, a time of concern for our responsibilities to others in the world around us. Because long ago, we learned the lesson that you cannot live by yourself. Isolationism is not only politically disastrous, it is morally wrong. In this, the age of nuclear weapons, the option of America first and others take care of themselves not only runs contrary to our principles of morality, but I submit to this group of men and women who know the political life of our nation that it imperils our own security. So now let me address myself for a few moments to what are our world responsibilities. Well, they are not to serve as self-appointed global policemen. They are not to impose our will or ourselves in any and all situations across the map. They are not to make the world or remake the world in our image. These are not American goals or objectives or responsibilities. But our responsibilities are to use this gift of our wealth, our strength, our influence in those situations where we believe that world peace and security and our own vital interests are involved. The ultimate objective of this nation is to secure a just and an enduring peace, to help create those conditions in which peace can live. Now, what has this meant in practical terms rather than general rhetoric? Well, it has meant a Marshall Plan, an alliance for progress. It has meant NATO and CETO. It has meant a full and unremitting commitment to the United Nations. It has meant our support for political and economic union and unity of Western Europe. It has meant our leadership in widening trade and economic growth around the world. It has meant the Peace Corps, Food for Peace, Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, bridge building with the nations of Eastern Europe, and peaceful coexistence with the Soviet Union. All of that has been a part of our world responsibility. None of it, may I say, that came easily. All of it bitterly opposed. And it has meant, too, the necessity of firmness even at the point of nuclear danger in Berlin. aid to Greece and Turkey, the support of Iran when her independence was threatened, resistance to open communist aggression in Korea, and the determination that the Soviet Union could not place her nuclear missiles into the Western Hemisphere. Every one of these decisions fraught with frightful danger, any one of which could have exploded into a tragic war, one of which resulted in one of the bloodiest wars of our history in Korea. And these world responsibilities have meant, in other cases, peacekeeping and peacemaking efforts, both on our own part and with other nations and international organizations. In such places as Lebanon, the Congo, where we have kept the peace, the Dominican Republic, and now, in recent weeks, Cyprus, where the danger of a major conflict that could have burst into World War III was averted by your president and his emissary. In the past few months alone, we've not only involved ourselves as peacemakers in Cyprus, but also in new efforts towards economic cooperation and integration in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Critical initiatives towards nuclear non-proliferation treaty and a slowdown of the arms race. These are the initiatives of your president, of your country, and of your government. And then we have been involved in that drab and gray but necessary work of world monetary reform, the successful Kennedy Round trade negotiation, which has opened the way for freer and faster growing world economy, newer outer space and consular treaties, which have eased tensions amongst the superpowers. I would remind my fellow Democrats that the only treaties that this administration has signed are treaties that lend themselves towards peace. Now, none of these efforts have been without cost or travail. In some of them, the costs have been indeed high. Peacekeeping and peacemaking are costly, tedious, oftentimes very dangerous undertakings. But I submit that not to have acted, not to have given leadership, could have and would have been more costly and more dangerous. We've been involved, too, in that part of the world known as Southeast Asia and Vietnam. And we've been involved as a Pacific power. I remind this audience that more Americans have given their lives since Pearl Harbor in the Pacific and the Asian areas of the world than in Europe. We've been a Pacific power ever since California became a state of this union, and surely since Hawaii became the 50th. Now, as you know, I recently returned from a mission to three Southeast Asian countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Vietnam. This was my fifth journey, my fifth mission into Asia. I do not say that taking a journey or a trip into Asia equips you to be an expert, but I do submit that it gives you a feel of the situation. And I also submit that our most severe critics are those who have never been there, rather than those who have gone on the spot to do their research and their evaluation. Now, we're going to discuss this in the question and answer period, so I won't go into the details. At this moment, I simply want to point out that each of these three nations that I just mentioned all have a distinctive character, but all share two vital common denominators. And here are the common denominators of the free nations of Asia. All have had firsthand, hard, real, living, not theoretical experience with Asian communist subversion and aggression on a life or death basis. Communist aggression is not a subject of academic discussion in Malaysia, but fought the communists for 12 long years. Nor is it a subject of academic discussion in any part of Asia, where they face the constant threat of expansionist, militant Asian communism. Now, what's the second common denominator of these countries? Well, they have all launched urgent priority programs towards peaceful development and constructive nation building in their own countries. And these are tasks in which we are helping, the tasks of national security and national development, neither one of which can exist without the other. And I bear down on that point. It isn't good enough just to want to help build a great nation or a good nation. It has to be defended. And it isn't enough to build merely the military power of a country. It has to have a social and political and economic base. National security and national development, one and inseparable. Now, over these years, as I've said, I've visited many of these countries. All have relied to some degree on our shield of strength while trying to build new growth and regional cooperation to sustain themselves. Now, wherever I've been, without exception, free Asian leaders, without exception, have made it clear that if we were to abandon our role in Asia, were we to pull back before they could fully stand on their own feet, which they're desperately trying to do, they would be under immediate pressure to come to terms with Asian communism, which they have resisted for over 20 years. Every leader tells us this, there and here. Now, we cannot turn away from this vital area, and it is vital to us. It's rich in resources, high in strategic importance, and it contains more than half of the world's population. The future of peace or war depends on Asia. The life of this nation may very well depend on what develops in Asia. And therefore, our real interest in this part of the world. Now, we're not going to spend time here talking about the pros and cons of what might have been done in the past by many people and many nations to avoid our present involvement in Asia. We can't relive those days. But we are talking about the hard facts today of communist aggression and subversion across a vast continent. And I submit that we're talking about a regime in mainland China which soon can be armed with nuclear weapons, which preaches and believes, regrettably, the dogma, cynically misnamed, the war of national liberation. We're talking about independent nations, millions and millions of people who are next door neighbors to that regime. Now, don't get me wrong. I do not propose to isolate or attack or inflame communist China. Such would be madness. What I do propose, and what our president proposes, is that we follow in Asia the same course which we so successfully followed in Europe and elsewhere in this world, a dual policy of firmness and a willingness to peacefully coexist. And that's why I've talked of containment without isolation of communist China, of policies of bridge building. That's why our president has advocated reconciliation and peaceful development of an entire continent without regard to ideology. And that's why we are in Vietnam, using our power with the utmost restraint for clear and limited goals. That is why we are avoiding the easier, but I think the much more dangerous options of either withdrawal or reaching out for those weapons of mass destruction that could bring on the Holocaust of World War III. Now, let me make myself clear. This country and this political party are big enough for differences of degree in opinions on Vietnam. The Democratic Party nationally and the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota is big enough to accommodate different views on this issue. But just as this administration has been one of concern, so has our party always been one of concern when it comes to tolerance of the other man's views, to respect honestly held differences. Our party is not a one-issue party, unless that issue is our uncompromising commitment to human rights and the ideas that men should be free of all tyranny and coercion. That is the central principle. But just as I've indicated to you, just as we are concerned, we who bear the responsibility for decision must also be prepared to carefully examine the various policy options available in each situation, to weigh the consequences of each possible course, none of which satisfy all of our requirements, and then to decide to act, as painful as that decision and action may be. And this is what we have done. You are members of a governing party in this country, my fellow Democrats. We're responsible in a large measure for the course of history of this country. And while it is entirely right and fitting and proper, and indeed it is essential that there be discussion, dialogue, debate, and dissent, there comes an hour and a time when you must decide. And it is the decision-making that is the difficult assignment. And those who are entrusted with the role of leadership do not have just the luxury of dissent and discussion, dialogue and debate. We must decide. We must choose the options. And we do the best that we know how. I believe it is especially important that those in our party who prize dissent, as I do, who properly defend each man's right to disagree, should, if they cannot agree with some aspect of our present policy, clearly detail and enunciate the alternative policy courses and actions which they favor. For I believe that with each American right comes an American responsibility. I believe the responsibility to come forth with positive, constructive alternatives is the other side of the coin of your disagreement. Now, there have been questions raised even among those who acknowledge the critical importance of Southeast Asia as to whether or not Vietnam is important in this larger scheme. And these are legitimate questions, the kind of questions that ought to be raised. Indeed, if in fact the question is asked, if the loss of Vietnam would have any effect on the rest of Asia? Now, as I said earlier, the leaders of Free Asia believe that it would. Only recently, the Prime Minister of Japan, who for a long period of time sort of stood away, hands off, unqualifiedly stated at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., that our presence in Vietnam was considered by the Asian leaders that he had visited with vital, vital, he said, to their security and to their independence. Many of these nations have sent troops and non-military assistance to South Vietnam. And I might add, for your information, if it has escaped your attention, there are more troops and assistance from other nations in South Vietnam than were present in Korea. Now, what about our own leaders, men that we've placed our trust in? President John Kennedy put it this way in September 1963 when interviewed by the NBC commentator David Brinkley. Mr. Brinkley said, "Mr. President, have you any reason to doubt this so-called domino theory that if South Vietnam falls, the rest of Southeast Asia will go behind it?" Now, I give you the exact words of President Kennedy. President Kennedy, "No, I believe it. I believe it. I think that the struggle is close enough. China is so large, looms so high, just beyond the frontiers, that if South Vietnam went, it would not only give them an improved geographic position for a guerrilla assault on Malaya, but would also give the impression that the wave of the future in Southeast Asia was China and the communists. So I believe it." End of quote. And may I say, there's a whole body of evidence. I left during the question period, we can go into more of it, a whole body of evidence as to what our presidents thought. And Adlai Stevenson, in his letter to Hubert Humphrey, November 31st, 1964, enclosing to me a copy of an official memorandum to our government. Here are his exact words. "The principal threat to world peace and world security in the foreseeable future will almost certainly be communist China. It is arrogant, aggressive, resourceful, and resolute. It is already stronger militarily than any other state in Asia except the Soviet Union. And its military strength, including its ability to make and deliver nuclear weapons, is likely to grow much faster than has been forecast." Just an aside, what a prophet he was. Politically, Stevenson said, its prestige amongst the colored peoples as the most powerful and successful colored nation will prosper. And it will use that prestige and its disproportionate and a disproportionate share of its resources to extend its influence and to create maximum disorder in Asia and Africa. End of quote. Neither Mr. Kennedy nor Mr. Stevenson were unconcerned about Vietnam or China. Both of them saw the threat. But those men, and I repeat, were concerned Democrats, just as you and I. And I quote earlier the Vietnam peace objective. A peace objective that I quoted, or that I want to quote to you from one of our very distinguished senators and fellow citizens. Defining his goal of peace in Vietnam, "I am for an honorable, rational, political solution of this war. A solution which I believe will enhance our world position, encourage the respect of our allies and political adversaries, which will permit us to give the necessary attention to other commitments at home and abroad, military and non-military, and leave us with resources and moral energy to deal effectively with the pressing domestic problems of the United States itself." Ladies and gentlemen, that is the full position of this administration. President Johnson, speaking of Vietnam, said, "We are united in our determination that the South Vietnamese people shall not be conquered by aggressive force, and shall enjoy the inherent right to choose their own way of life and their own form of government. Our sole demand on the leaders of North Vietnam," and I repeat it, "our sole demand on the leaders of North Vietnam is that they abandon their aggression. We are prepared to pursue any avenue which could lead to a secure and just peace, whether through discussion and negotiation or through reciprocal actions by both sides to reduce the violence." And then he went on to say about our objective in Asia. And I think we need to understand what our objective is. "The peace we seek," said President Johnson, "in Asia is a peace of conciliation between communist states and non-communist neighbors, between rich nations and poor, between small nations and large, between men whose skins are brown and black and yellow and white, between Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists and Christians. It is a peace that can only be sustained through the durable bonds of peace, through international trade, through the free flow of people and ideas, through full participation by all nations in an international community under law, and through a common dedication to the great tasks of human progress and economic development." That's the goal of your country. That's the commitment of this nation. And we have sought ceaselessly to achieve that peace. On four separate occasions, as your vice president, I went to the leaders of countries of Asia with this message: to the president of India, to the president of Pakistan, to country after country, seeking their good offices for this kind of a world, only to be told again and again that there was no answer in Hanoi, that there was no response. Thus far, our adversary has turned us down, as he has turned down everyone else. The United Nations, the Pope, and third parties around the world. But I come to you to tell you, we will not stop trying. We are going to pursue this noble goal of a just peace. And as we try, I believe the cause of peace would be done a great disservice by anything less than a demonstration of our will to sustain the effort necessary to achieve it. I mean the effort necessary not only to persist diplomatically, but also to persist in turning back the aggression in South Vietnam, the work of national security, in helping to build there, as we are, a stable, growing, responsive, constitutionally based society, and above all, the work of national development. I believe we cannot afford to regard the struggle in Vietnam as Neville Chamberlain regarded Hitler's conquest of Czechoslovakia when he put it this way: "A quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing." Surely this great party and country has learned the lessons of the 30s. Surely we have learned that the appetite of the aggressor is insatiable. Surely we have learned that appeasement does not bring peace. Surely we have learned that by firmness and resolution, without being belligerent or bellicose, that we can walk forward in the path of peace. Our nation has learned in the past the costly lesson of deferring manageable troubles until they become unmanageable. And I am not one that believes we ought to get Armageddon on the installment plan by backing up. So, to repeat our mistakes again, in the year 25 of the nuclear age, and that's what it is, would I believe be not only irresponsible, but downright immoral and possibly fatal for our children, if not for us. So I welcome questioning. I welcome discussion here as I have across this entire land. And my only request is this: let us be responsible citizens. Let our arguments be reasonable and thoughtful, and let it take into account the realities of what they face, because the stakes for our country are mighty high, and we ought not to play loosely with the future destiny of what Lincoln well called, and what we know to be, the last best hope on earth. I welcome your questions. Thank you very much.